I'm up on a tight wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon, and welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. I'm going it alone today, but I have a wonderful guest. His name is Manuel Ramos, and he just came out with a new book called Desperado, A Mile High Noir, which is kind of like a Chicano mystery detective fiction with a bunch of intrigue that not only has to do with the city of Denver and regentrification of a traditionally Latino neighborhood, but also the shroud of the Virgin Mary that Juan Diego held and is supposed to have her imprint. Somebody stole it, and that's even part of the intrigue. So that's going to be a nice show. And the poem of the week is going to be a surprise. Stick around because it's one of my favorite poems, and I think you're going to like it. We're going to talk to Manuel Ramos, who lives in Denver, Colorado. And I met him in California at the Latino Book Fair. It's this book fair that they used to have every year, but because of budgeting, they haven't done it. But I was doing a panel with Timzy Hernandez and Alex Espinosa. After all the events, we had this really big dinner, and it was really nice. Everyone sat at banquet tables, and everything was paid for all the writers. So we had this wonderful dinner with wine and entertainment. And at the table, I sat with Manuel Ramos and his wife. His book that captured my attention was called King of the Chicanos, and it's out by Wings Press. You got to see this cover. It's this, I would say, thin, kind of dorky-looking, perhaps, Chicano with a big crown on his head, as if he's a self-appointed king. And it's really a wonderful, funny novel. So I'm glad I got a chance to have him on the show finally. And this new novel is fantastic. But he lives in Denver. And Denver is one of the states that has legalized recreational marijuana. So how could you not write when you live in Denver? I'm kidding. I don't think you need to have drugs to write. I think you need to have drugs after you write. Anyway, I'm Daniel Chacon. Stick around, and we're going to talk to my friend Manuel Ramos about his new book. Manuel Ramos is a fiction writer who has won the Colorado Book Award, the Chicano Latino Literary Award, the Top Hand Award from the Colorado Authors League, and two honorable mentions from the Latino International Book Awards. The Montes series, which is a series of detective novels, debuted with The Ballad of Rocky Ruiz and was a finalist for the Edgar Award from the Mystery Writers of America. His published works include the mainstream novel King of the Chicanos, several short stories, poems, nonfiction articles, and a handbook on Colorado landlord-tenant law, now in fifth edition. He is co-founder of and regular contributor to La Bloga, an award-winning internet magazine devoted to Latino literature, culture, news, and opinion. His latest novel is Desperado, A Mile High Noir, published by Arte Publico Press in 2013. Manuel, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Well, thank you, Daniel. I'm so happy to be here.
We met one time. I don't know if you remember that, but it was at the Latino Book Festival in East L.A. a couple of years ago.
I remember that. Yeah, they were showing Chicano music, Chicano soul music, rock and roll or something like that.
Something like that. Yeah, I think Luis Rodriguez was sitting with us, and Timzy Hernandez, and
bunch of rowdies.
Yeah. And so that was the first time I got to meet you, but I've certainly enjoyed your new novel. It's called Desperado, A Mile High Noir. Congratulations on this book. It's fantastic.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that came out in the spring, Arte Publico Press. I'm really proud of it. You know, it's a dark mystery crime fiction, Chicano noir, and so I'm happy it got published. I think Arte Publico actually has a nice track record of doing crime fiction. It's probably not known for that, but if you look in the catalog and its history, it's published a lot of good crime fiction, so I'm happy to be part of that.
And Manuel Ramos has a pretty good history of publishing crime fiction, too. You've been writing mysteries for a long time. This is what you're... Seventh, eighth book?
This is my eighth book, Daniel. My first one came out 20 years ago, hard to believe.
Wow.
The Ballad of Rocky Ruiz. That was the start of my series with Chicano lawyer Luis Montes.
Right.
And I did 5 books about Louis. Then I did a standalone Private Eye novel, very dark, The Mooney's Road to Hell. Did a non-crime fiction novel a few years ago, King of the Chicanos.
Right, right. I love that cover, King of the Chicanos. I saw that at a book festival one time. Where was it? I think it was in Albuquerque. And I go, I got to know this guy.
That art is by Cesar Martinez.
Yeah, a very well-known Chicano artist.
Right. I've been lucky with that. Actually, Desperado has a painting by Adan Hernandez.
So. Oh, wow. It's a beautiful, beautiful cover, yeah. So this novel, the Denver Post, I think it was, says, Manuel Ramos is to North Denver what Walter Mosley is to Los Angeles.
Ooh. Shoot, man.
That's quite a compliment for Walter Mosley. So you set this in North Denver. Tell us a little bit about North Denver for our listeners who don't know too much about it.
Yeah. Well, you know, historically, North Denver was a Chicano neighborhood, and it was very diverse, though. I've lived here now. My wife and I have lived here in the North Side for more than 30 years, so we've seen a lot of changes. But historically, it was very much of a diverse community, had a lot of history, a lot of culture. There were always all kinds of things going on here. There still are, actually.
Right.
And over the years, we've seen it change. You know, we've seen different ethnic groups move in and out. We've seen some of the culture change. But this latest change is gentrification. And it's, unfortunately, it's becoming a little more homogenous. You know, that's the drama in the background of the book.
Absolutely, yeah. That it's like as the plot moves on, that gentrification that's happening really deepens everything.
What's actually going on and in people's lives, and so that's always good background for crime fiction. You know,
right.
The things that people really live through, and then you throw in a murder or two.
What I really like this novel, and what I tell my my students, and actually what I tell anybody, you know, even if they don't want to listen. Is the difference between superficial fiction and good fiction is that superficial fiction has a metaphor running through it, whereas good fiction has metaphorical possibilities, just infinite metaphorical possibilities. And I love that it's set in two backgrounds that just allow for so much metaphorical possibility, and that is the gentrification of North Denver and the drama with the Tilma,
right?
You know, which is the you could probably explain it better exactly what it is.
Well, the Holy Shawl of the Virgin Mary, it's actually Juan Diego's shawl, which printed the vision of the Virgin.
Somebody stole it from the Basilica in this novel. And so you have these two things that are going on in the background. It just kind of gives the book a lot more depth. How did you come up with having these two things working side by side? And what does it mean to you in terms of the novel?
Sure. Well, the novel actually, its genesis is in a short story that I published in an anthology called Hit List a few years ago. Hit List, The Best of Latino Mystery. And the short story there was the skull of Pancho Villa. And actually, that's another symbol, if you will.
Right.
You know, the skull gets stolen from this family, the Correls, and there's a long history there of how the skull ended up with that family. And Gus Correll, the guy who's at the center of the story, is this down-and-out Chicano trying to cope with change. He goes out and becomes a detective because he's trying to find the missing skull. Well, I just took that idea a little further, you know. I mean, identity is such a big issue in Chicano writing always, and you know, these things kind of come together, the changes that are going on in the neighborhoods, the changes that are really happening around this guy, whether he can adapt, and then there's this big change of the stealing of the Tilma, what that really means, and how he gets wrapped up in it is of course part of the mystery. But you know, I don't try to be too heavy-handed with things, so I don't really think that much consciously about symbols or metaphors.
Right, exactly, yeah.
When the writing comes out, you know, readers do what they do with it.
Right, and it's that not fixing in on a particular symbol or metaphor with these things in the background that deepen it rather than singularize it and make it more superficial, like if it meant just one thing.
Right.
But it doesn't. And another detail that I really think is wonderful for this novel is the fact that Gus Corral, he's kind of down and out, is, you know, he's divorced and doesn't have too much money. And I won't call him a loser, but let's just say things ain't going his way.
Yeah. He's living in the back room of his ex-wife Segunda. So.
Right, and that's the other thing that I wanted to talk about, the fact that he runs a secondhand store. What a wonderful detail. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, unfortunately, that used to be something that was not that unusual in his neighborhood. You know, I mean, people would take their stuff, and there were Segundas, and you know, families would go shopping, and you'd look for that bargain, or you'd look for that little piece of treasure. And unfortunately, now they're becoming, you know, they're no longer Segundas, they're boutiques.
Or they're antique stores now, and they charge a lot more.
Right, exactly. Everything all of a sudden is much more valuable for some reason here on the north side, even though it's the same old stuff.
Right.
But so, of course, Gus is trying to make that work for his ex-wife, but it's also, you know, part of what's happening.
Right. And I think that's also just a wonderful, another wonderful metaphor for working class Chicanos and working class Chicano neighborhoods. I remember when I was a kid, you know, my mom, you know, she would drag us from secondhand store to secondhand store, even when she didn't need anything, just to see if she could find anything good. It's like, but you get rid of those and you do get rid of a little bit of the flavor, I guess, of the neighborhood. Can you tell us about how gentrification is affecting the working class Latino population in North Denver?
Yeah, it's massive here, this change. Like I said, I've been here for more than 30 years, and I've seen all kinds of changes, and those were gradual, and, you know, people learn to live together. But this thing is like overnight. They're tearing down houses and putting up these ugly box condos. And
I can picture those, yeah.
You know, and they're all over this, what is a very nice residential neighborhood with brick homes and yards. And they're just scraping these houses down and putting these ugly boxes up. So, of course, there's all kinds of people now living in the neighborhood. Property values have gone up, so taxes are higher. It's not hard to find a decent place to eat. There are very good restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to find an inexpensive place to eat, you know, in the neighborhood. The schools are, right here in the few blocks around me, there's a nice school, a bilingual school. And yet it's getting surrounded by these, you know, by traffic and congestion. So it's jarring, actually. And, you know, there's good and bad to it. Change is like that. It's good and bad.
Right.
You just hate to see some of the old things go by. And what I hope for is that the new people moving in, the younger folks, the hipsters, that they have some commitment to the neighborhood. And, you know, they're going to stick it out. And when the fad is over, let's see what happens. You know, no longer hip to live here.
Yeah, and Gus Corral lives in that neighborhood and he's lived in it for a long time before the gentrification. But now, with the gentrification, he's finding himself even a little bit more, I guess you can say, alienated. The gentrification itself is making Gus more of a Chicano in a sense.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. The places he used to hang out, now they've changed, and he finds himself feeling like a stranger in his own backyard.
Right. Instead of getting a carne asada burrito, now he has to get a kale burrito wrapped in a sun-dried tomato tortilla.
Which, you know, there's a time and a place for it.
Absolutely. I love kale. Are you kidding? But yeah, you do lose something. And tell us a little bit about how Gus came around, Gus Corral. He's a wonderful character. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, he started in this short story when he goes searching for the skull of Pancho Villa.
Uh-huh.
Gus is that kind of guy. He grew up in the neighborhood. He grew up in the streets. He never fulfilled his potential. And his sisters, meanwhile, they're rocket scientists compared to him.
Mm-hmm.
They're successful. They're living their life. They seem to have more on the ball than Gus. They help get Gus out of trouble. But Gus is the kind of guy who is loyal. He's honest to the degree that, you know, is required.
That's a good way of putting it.
You know, he understands his own frailties and failures, and yet he's, you know, he's still, if anything, I think Gus is that kind of guy that he hasn't given up hope, even though he may be in a hopeless situation. So, I mean, not to get too heavy with the guy, but he's that kind of person, and not everybody's going to like a Gus Corral when you meet him. I hope you like him when you read about him, but you know, if you were to meet that kind of person, you might hesitate until you really got to know the guy.
Yeah, you know, and that's one of the things I really like about this book. We're talking to Manuel Ramos, author of the new book, Desperado, A Mile High Noir, We're talking about his character, Gus Corral. And one of the things about Gus Corral is, if I were to describe him to you, he might not seem like he's a very likable character. But what makes this novel work is that we really do end up liking him.
You got to have people in your books who are three-dimensional.
Absolutely.
I worry about that sometimes when I'm portraying the really bad guys.
Right.
You know, there's not a lot sometimes that I can say about people like that, but I still try to flesh them out a bit, give them
right.
a little more personality.
So. And if the really bad guys were the main focus of the novel, they really would have a lot more depth. Sometimes necessarily we don't focus on that part of a particular character, like the brother of the young woman who is in the center of this novel. He's crazy.
Yeah, Misty and Lorenzo.
Yeah, you might like him to observe him, but you probably wouldn't want to have a kale burrito with him.
Not with Lorenzo, no. Not with a guy who calls himself the butcher.
Writing a mystery novel, I've never written a mystery novel. But I do know that when I write a novel, or when a lot of people that I know that write a novel, they have the very last image before they start writing, even if they don't know how they're going to get there. The journey is where all the surprises come. That's where everything happens. I don't know a lot of literary writers who do outlines. Chapter one, this has to happen. In chapter two, this has to happen. But I have heard interviews with popular fiction writers where they do that, or other kind of, non-literary writers where they have everything mapped out and only then do they start writing. How is your process from writing a mystery novel different from writing a non-mystery novel?
In a mystery novel, you do have to be careful that when you finally get to the end and you reveal everything, that there are things in the book that have set it up, or at least hinted at it. I think in a straightforward mainstream novel, people can act however they want to act, and you can credit that to just that's the way people are.
Right.
But in a mystery, the mystery reader, at least, is going to want to know that whatever the writer did by the end, they didn't pull something out of their hat.
Right. There's no Scooby-Doo ending.
Right.
He takes off the mask, and all along it's been Mr. Green, the guy who owns the grocery store?
Yeah. Yeah, and you've got to be careful with that. Now, my writing is, the term I guess these days is organic. I start writing and let it go. To me, character is the most important thing. So
absolutely.
I start with characters and put them together and see what happens. There's only one of my novels where I actually knew what the ending was going to be, and I worked towards that. In these others, and Desperado wasn't any different. I kind of let it flow out, and it was about three quarters of the way before I realized exactly where I was headed and what was going on. So then that just means you go back and look at things and make sure you're still floating correctly here. So it's a process for me that I know I could never teach it, and I have a hard time explaining it. But once I'm in the middle of it, I like it and I get into it.
Yeah. We're talking to Manuel Ramos, author of Desperado, A Mile High Noir, which is a mystery novel taking place in North Denver. Manuel, most of us who write literary fiction have day jobs. What's your day job?
I'm a lawyer with Colorado Legal Services, which is the statewide legal aid program. I'm actually the director of advocacy, so I'm in senior management now. I'm getting ready to retire from that job next year.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of work. How do you find time to write?
I'm very disciplined when I am writing. I can't say that I write every day, but when I am in a project, then I do write every day, and I'm disciplined about it, and I set schedules and vacations and time off and things like that. But, I've been doing it now for more than 20 years. At the beginning, when my first book came out and I had a deadline and I was in court a lot and representing folks who were in emergency crises, it was harder, and it was something that kind of stretched me out. Over the years, I've learned to adapt, and I think now I look at writing as, it's something that I just do rather than, it's something extra. It's just part of what I do. And so I don't see it as an intrusion anymore or, something extra that's going to take up more time. It's really something I want to do. And so,
well, I'm glad you said that because, what I don't understand sometimes when people who want to be writers, they feel so guilty for not writing. Just write. Writers write. And, the fact is, if you have time to, pretty much do anything, watch a TV show, read a newspaper, check Facebook, you have time to write.
Yeah, no, that's exactly the way I feel about it. And like I said, when I'm in a project, when I'm really on something, then, you know, it does become part of my regular routine. It's, you know, you have breakfast or you go for a run and you do some writing. And
when do you write? What time of day, generally?
I'm more of a morning person, you know, and get up and try to do what I can and see how long that'll last. And especially when I'm taking time off from my regular work and trying to finish something up. Next month, I'm going to start full-blown again on another book, and I'll be away in some other place where I can focus. And,
yeah. Morning makes sense to me. I think, you know, that book, From Where We Dream by Robert Olin Butler, one of the best pieces of advice he has is to have very little separation from the dream world, the literal dream world, and the writing time. You wake up and start writing. And one of the reasons he says is because if you do it at night, and you can do it at night, there's been great writers who have done it at night, but if you do it at night, you've been using language and emotion all day in a way that may cause you to use language in, he says, more dishonest ways.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about it that deeply, but yeah, I am more productive in the morning. And, I mean, not that I never have written at night, but it's a little more, I can grab it quicker, I think, in the morning.
Thank you, Manuel Ramos, for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Well, thank you, Daniel. It's been a pleasure.
For Poem of the Week, I am going to read one of my favorite depressing poets, Cesar Vallejo, a.k.a. El Pocho. This is a poem called Dregs, which kind of, in many ways, represents a lot of his emotional landscapes. I remember the first time I read him was when Andres Montoya, my roommate, used to read his poems aloud. And the one he used to like to read was, the first line was, "Today I am just in despair." And this one is just as depressing. It's called Dregs by Cesar Vallejo, and this is translated by Clayton Eichmann. "This afternoon it is raining as never before, and I have no desire to live, my heart. This afternoon is sweet. Why should it not be? Dressed in grace and pain, dressed like a woman. This afternoon in Lima, it is raining, and I recall the cruel caverns of my ingratitude, my block of ice over her poppy, stronger than her, don't be this way, my violent black flowers and the barbaric and terrible stoning, and the glacial distance and the silence of her dignity, with burning holy oils will put all end to it. So this afternoon, as never before, I am with this owl, with this heart. Other women go by and see me so sad, they take on a bit of you in the abrupt wrinkle of my deep remorse. This afternoon it is raining, raining hard, and I have no desire to live, my heart." That was Dregs by Cesar Vallejo.
This is Patrick Michael Finn. I'm a writer who lives in Gilbert, Arizona, and I've written a novella as well as a collection of short stories. And I'm going to read an essay, a brief essay, called "Best of Luck Placing This Elsewhere." My short story collection came out a couple years ago. I won't mention the title, as I too cringe when writers of essays about writing mention their own books in the first sentence, no less. But bear with me. I write this story of my stories in the spirit of buoying confidence about your own hard-to-place poetry and short story manuscripts, because my collection was mercilessly difficult to finally get published, as were the individual stories that appeared in journals before the collection got picked up. I changed my mind. My book's title is From the Darkness Right Under Our Feet. A more suitable title might have been From the Darkness at the Bottom of Countless Publishers' Slush Piles, where my collection lived for nearly 6 years. Many of those submissions were to contests, of course, and not once did my collection make a long list or short list of finalists. And the individual stories? Every previously published story in the book was rejected at least 40 times before it finally found a home. Others were rejected 50, 75 times. The record? One story collected 175 rejections over the course of 5 years before Anya Groner at the Yalabusha Review said yes. Those years of submission and rejection were, mind you, before the advent of the online submission manager. I don't want to do the math for postage, paper, and contest entry fees. We all know that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and so on. So was I crazy to keep sending it out after, say, 80 rejections? No. And neither are you. You have to believe that an editor like Anya Groner is out there waiting for you, because she is, no matter how many years it takes to find her. I studied with novelist and short story writer Elizabeth Evans in grad school at the University of Arizona. A graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop, Elizabeth told me she studied alongside many, many talented young writers who never went on to publish a book. I was shocked. Iowa students? For whatever reasons, they gave up. Did I ever feel like giving up? Oh my. But one of the things that kept me sending out, kept me writing, was the conclusion to Elizabeth's story. You have to have a sense of your own destiny. All of your favorite writers, no matter how well known, still face rejection. Before the 2009 publication of Paget Powell's The Interrogative Mood, a novel, roughly 10 years had passed since his last book. But in that decade, he wrote two collections of stories, both of which remain unpublished. I'm certain they're brilliant, like the rest of his work. So the next time you find a thin SASE in your mailbox, be patient. Easier said than done, of course. But I think the pain that accompanies rejection is still easier to take than the despair of giving up for good. This is Patrick Michael Finn for Words on a Wire.
I'd like to thank my guest, Manuel Ramos, for joining us on Words on a Wire. And don't forget to look at his new book, Get Involved in the Intrigue. And I'd also like to thank Cesar Vallejo for living such a depressing existence so he could share the beauty of sadness with us. I'm Daniel Chacon. Join us next week for another edition of Words on a Wire. And don't forget, the next book you read might depress the hell out of you.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tight rope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see. And the wire seems to be the only place. Me, a comedy of errors and a